leave the world of the living behind. Stories, fables, and ghostly tales await.
There is something fundamentally unsettling about water, isn't there? We look at the surface and it reflects the world back at us. It seems peaceful, polite even, but that surface is just a mask. We cannot breathe it, we cannot long survive it. And worst of all, we cannot see what waits beneath its muddy edges or in its black, abyssal depths. Water is necessary for life. Yep, but nature, in its infinite sense of ironic humor, also made water one of the world's most efficient systems for hiding a secret, or a secret body. Dinner lights, my friends, settle in close to your lanterns tonight. We are opening a special ledger in the archives, one that blurs the legal definition between mythology and criminal history. We are playing a game with the darkness. Something different today. I call it Deep Waters, Dark Tides. Three tales, one truth. Tonight, I'll present you with three detailed accounts of tragedy and horror, involving the unforgiving element of water in Japanese history and folklore. I will tell them all with the same narrative weight, with the same descriptive flair, and with the same respect for the darkness. But there is a catch, and where your analytical skills come into play. Only one of these accounts is factually, historically true. Only one. The other two, while perhaps rooted in very real social anxieties or unexplained tragedies, are pure folklore, fables, and mythology. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, which is a yes, because you're listening, is to analyze the details, listen past my performance, and determine which of these deep, dark tides actually swept across our reality. Do not be fooled by which one seems more believable. Sometimes the truth is far lazier and much more cruel than fiction. I want you to leave a comment with your guess before the reveal timer. Lock in your answers. Do not cheat the ledgers. We will reveal this historic truth, unmasking the historic records at the 28-minute mark, or thereabouts. Do not skip ahead, or I'll put you in a barrel and float you down the Tone River. We begin in the soft, warm, muddy shallows of the Edo period. Come on. Let's do this together. Our journey through the dark tides begins in the mid-18th century in a small, quiet rice farming village along the bend of the Tone River, located in what is now modern-day Ibaraki Prefecture. It was a community built on silence and predictability. In those days, your life was largely defined by the movement of the seasons and the behavior of the rivers. The Tone River provided the fish, the irrigation for the rice paddies, and the transportation, but the river demanded a price for its hospitality, and the villagers paid it with reverence and with fear. If you walked along the riverbank in 1750 and listened to the tall grasses rustling in the wind, you wouldn't just hear nature. You might hear the elders whispering a single word, spoken with a mixture of terror and a weirdly pragmatic sense of respect. Kappa. You know the name, of course. The kappa is Japan's most iconic and, depending on your source, sometimes its most bizarrely polite river monster. Folklore describes them as bipedal amphibious imps, about the size of a 5 or 6 year old human child. They have green or yellowish scaly skin, webbed hands and feet that allows them to move with terrifying speed underwater, and a beak-like mouth. On their back, they carry a turtle-like shell. But what makes a kappa supernatural and what defines its weakness is the sara, or plate, a bowl-shaped indentation on the very top of its skull. This sara holds water from its home river. As long as that plate is wet, the kappa possesses supernatural, devastating strength. If the water ever spills, it becomes completely powerless. It's an odd biological design, like driving a sports car with the engine exposed to the rain. Now, while the kappa is famous for simple pranks, things like stealing cucumbers from gardens, which they prefer to human flesh, thankfully, farting loudly near temples, that could just be a person, or trying to peek at women bathing, The criminal registers of this Tawny River village tell a much darker tale. These were not pranks. This was predation. In the summer of 1754, the Tawny River was lower than usual. And as the river levels dropped, the cuppa reports and the disappearance registers skyrocketed. In those ledgers, we find the account of an Edo period peasant farmer named Jiro. Jiro had two things of value: a 12-year-old son, Takeshi, and a very sturdy, valuable farm horse. Takeshi was, according to neighbors, a thoughtful, obedient boy. But one evening, just as the sun was setting and painting the river red, Takeshi was walking the horse back along the narrow river path after a day in the upper field. Neighbors working nearby reported hearing the splash first. It wasn't a sudden frantic splash or the sound of an accidental fall. It was the heavy intentional surge of something bursting from the shallows. And then silence, absolute heavy silence, broken only by a single desperate whinny from the horse. Jiro sprinted to the path. He found the horse standing in the shallow mud, its front legs trembling, the broken lead rope lying in the water. But Takeshi was gone. The villagers grabbed torches and pitchforks, the standard issue response for pre-industrial community panic, and searched the muddy shallows for hours. They didn't find the boy, but they did find the signs. They found the heavy, three-toed, clawed footprint in the mud that matched no known animal in Hyogo. More chillingly, Jiro reported that the muddy path leading down from the grass was covered in a slick, gelatinous slime, the signature of a kappa who had stepped out of its element to ambush its prey. The elders didn't suggest a further search. They ordered all doors locked and reflective metal mirrors placed near all windows, traditional defenses against supernatural intruders. They said the boy had been borrowed by the river. 3 days later, Takeshi's body was found floating face down in a calm eddy a mile downstream. And here we leave the realm of cute folklore and enter absolute forensic horror. Edo period coroner reports from this village describe victims of kappa attacks that look nothing like accidental drownings. They bear very specific mutilations. The kappa possesses an unholy, obsessive focus on the human Shiridama, a mythical bull containing the soul, located at the base of the lower intestines. They were said to extract this bull through the most graphic and violating means imaginable, using their beaks. Goodness. Takeshi's body, according to the 1754 criminal record, bore this exact signature. He was pale, bloated, his body fully intact, except for a violent, circular incision at the anus, and his internal organs completely missing. It's an oddly specific culinary preference, isn't it, to ignore the eyes or the tongue, but travel across dimensions specifically to perform butt surgery. Folklore monsters are nothing if not committed to a theme, and a terrifying one at that. Good gravy. For 300 years, rural Japan farming communities feared the soft mud of the riverbeds. They built walls, they placed offering tables of cucumbers along the shore, and they bowed deeply to nothing if they heard a noise in the reeds, knowing that a kappa was supernaturally compelled to bow back, spilling its strength water. And the question tonight, were these Edo period criminal registers filled with descriptions of mutilated bodies and three-toed footprints, documenting a very real, very physical amphibious predator that predated on isolated children and livestock? Or were they the desperate narrative constructs of a pre-scientific society needing to blame a mythical monster for the tragic, messy reality of accidental drownings? Leave your guess below. Story number one, the kappa. We move now from the shallow, warm river mud of 1754 and travel forward in time, stepping onto the metal decks of a Japanese fishing trawler in the open ocean, sometime in the autumn of 1932. We are leaving behind pre-industrial simplicity and embracing modern machinery, which nature has no respect for whatsoever. The story takes place in the Sea of Japan, which, let's face it, has one of the worst PR problems in maritime history. Trawlers operating out of Niigata Prefecture were set sail for weeks at a time, navigating isolation, extreme weather, and a collective psychological fatigue that was known to drive experienced sailors absolutely mad. Not a fun place. In the autumn of 1932, a medium-sized Japanese trawler named the Hoshimaru was on its 14th day at sea. They were looking for a late-season school of mackerel and had pushed past their safety envelope, driven by the pragmatic necessity of bringing home a full haul. The ship was commanded by Captain Sato, a 15-year-old veteran whose face looked like it had been sculpted out of metal and salt. Sato was not a man prone to superstition. He was a man prone to analyzing barometric pressure, managing diesel fuel reserves, and maintaining strict discipline among his crew of 12. By the 15th night, Sato's pragmatism was put on the ultimate test. A severe, rapid-onset autumn gale hit them. The weather moved too fast to run for cover. Sato ordered his crew to batten down the hatches and prepare to ride it out. This was standard operating procedure for the Sea of Japan. You secure the deck here, you go below, and you pray your metal hull doesn't fatigue before the wind does. By 2 a.m., the storm was at its apex. The Hoshimaru was getting battered, the metal groaning with every impact of the massive 40-foot waves. The visibility was zero. A blinding curtain of rain and sea spray made it impossible to see further than the front rail. And then, above the howl of the gale, a new sound cut through. Captain Sato, who was working on the bridge, initially assumed the hatch had failed. But the sound wasn't coming from inside the ship. It was coming from the port side. One of his youngest crewmen, Aki, had been tasked with securing a loose oil barrel on the forward deck. He sprinted back to the bridge, collapsing against the wheel, his face pale and eyes wide. He didn't speak, he just pointed through the blinding rain toward the open ocean. Sato walked to the window and wiped the condensation away. Through the chaos, another ship had appeared, running parallel to them, just 50 feet away. It was an archaic, wooden junk-style vessel, its timbers rotten and hard. It carried no lights and operated with impossible stability in the high waves, navigating the surge as if the laws of physics didn't apply. But it was the people on the ship that were disturbing. Sato could see them through the gale, dozens of them. They were not walking, but marching in a tight, robotic rhythm around the main deck. They were not wearing foul weather gear. They were draped in tattered white shini shozoku, the traditional white burial garments used in Japanese funerals. As the ships drew closer, Sato's crew heard the demands, a low, collective chant rising from the phantom vessel, a request that ignored the rules of communication and embedded itself directly in their minds. All they could hear were whispering voices of water, empty, give us, we need to bail. The Hoshimaru's crew were experienced sailors, and traditional Japanese culture means you don't just learn how to operate a winch, you learn who owns the waves. They immediately recognized the signature of the Funayure, or boat spirits. The Fuyanure are the vengeful ghosts of sailors who died in tragic shipwrecks or maritime disasters and did not receive proper burial rites. They are doomed to haunt the very waves that claimed them. Navigating their phantom ship through the Sea of Japan, appearing during storms to lonely vessels, and politely demanding a way to save their sinking ship. The demand tonight was simple. They held up a dipper, a hishaku, and gestured for the Hoshimaru to share one of their empty wooden bale dippers. Captain Sato's rational mind was screaming that this was impossible, but his survival instincts, honed by 30 years at sea, recognized that traditional knowledge was his only defense. He knew the rules of this maritime fable. If you hand a funayurai an empty wooden dipper, they will accept it, walk back to their phantom ship, and immediately begin relentlessly pouring sea water from their deck onto yours. No matter how fast you could bail the water back out, the ghost dipper was said to pour with infinite supernatural speed, quickly flooding your trawler until your ship and everyone on board was sent to the blackest depths of the Sea of Japan to join their ranks. The ocean's cruelest chain letter. Captain Sato sprinted to his deck, shouting at his crew over the storm, destroy every dipper, break the buckets, break the cups. He grabbed the sledgehammer and began smashing every bailing tool on the deck. He threw the wooden shards into the engine room furnace. He left them with nothing to bail with and nothing to share. The Hoshimaru somehow survived the night, the engine room furnace burning bright with bailing dipper fuel, they limped back to the port of Niigata 3 days later, completely exhausted. While Captain Sato's official log stated they were caught in the gale, his crew swore an oath that they had encountered the Funayurai fleet, and only by preventing the phantoms from bailing water onto their deck did they escape the cold embrace of the sea. A beautiful legend used to explain why so many fishing trawlers vanish without a trace in the Sea of Japan. Or was this 1932 Maritime Ledger entry recording a real supernatural catastrophe on the open ocean? Leave your guess below. Story number two, the Funayurai. And our final story, number three, the deepest cradles, the Kotobuki Hospital. This account brings us very close to the modern day, back to the year of 1948 in post-World War II Tokyo. I must warn you, my friends, the tone shifts completely. If tonight's theme is deep waters and dark tides, this story represents a different kind of darkness, the cold, silent, indifferent water that rises within a society when it's completely collapsed and the sacred trust is broken. There are no river imps here. There are no ghost ships. There is only a city of 6 million people trying and largely failing to find enough to eat. 1948 Tokyo was defined by devastation. 3 years after the 1945 firebombing campaigns, the city was still largely in ruins. Food was severely rationed, medicine was non-existent, and the black market was the only functional economy. The streets were filled with hundreds of thousands of orphaned children, and poverty was not a condition but a state of existence for the working class. Against this backdrop of suffering, the Kotobuki Maternity Hospital, located in the chaotic district of Shinjuku, was seen as a very rare beacon of hope. The hospital was owned and operated by a highly respected obstetrician and midwife named Miyuki Ishikawa. Ishikawa was viewed by the community as an absolute pillar of saintly post-war virtue. She specialized in helping families who had been displaced by the war, taking in pregnant women who had nowhere else to go, and she worked 18 hours a day, often taking payment in rice rather than yen, promising desperate mothers that she would care for their children. To many, Ishikawa was the only light keeping these mothers from total despair. But inside the nurseries of Kotobuki Maternity Hospital, a different kind of dark tide was rising. As 1948 began, rumors started circulating among the displaced mothers about what was really happening inside the sanitarium. They whispered that while Ishikawa faced the public as the savior, she had a different face for the children. These mothers whispered that when you handed your newborn over to Ishikawa's care, the child seemed to wither. They didn't cry for hunger. They didn't scream for warmth. They simply grew still. They claimed that Ishikawa had constructed a terrifyingly efficient system for managing her patient load. As her hospital filled up and her resources ran low, Ishikawa simply stopped providing care to the children she deemed unwanted or too costly. Pragmatism, you see, can be a serial killer's best defense. In a city where everyone is starving, who is going to notice when a baby stops eating? It's simply poor hospital management, not a murder conspiracy. Nature will take its course. That is one perspective. Mothers who managed to get hold of a child after they were handed over to Ishikawa's nursery claimed the conditions were horrific. Cradles were kept far too cold. Blankets were withheld. After the milk, well, the milk was just slightly too thin. The claims were that Ishikawa was intentionally starving the babies to death. She wasn't using violence. She wasn't using poison. She was simply allowing the fundamental elements of post-war Tokyo, the cold and the hunger, to extinguish their lives. Mothers claimed that to officially record the deaths as natural causes, cite post-war malnutrition or illness, Ishikawa would perform a specific ritual on the infants who were weakest. She would carry the starving, dying babies to the main washroom, turn on the tap, and hold them under cold, running water. This, they whispered, allowed her to accelerate pneumonia or hypothermia, ensuring the end was clean and quiet, allowing her to file the official death certificates and sell the empty cradle space to the next desperate family waiting in the ruins. The Shinjuku police of 1948 were busy managing food riots and black market gangs. They We're not paying attention to a saintly midwife's private sanitarium. But in January 1948, the Silent Water in Shinjuku was forced into the daylight. Two police officers working a completely unrelated black market investigation were canvassing a park near the Kotobuki Hospital when they performed a routine check on several suspicious burial sites and were led right to Ishikawa's clinic. When detectives stepped past Ishikawa and her saintly smile and entered the nurseries, they found a crime scene that would shock the entire nation of Japan. Inside the Kotobuki Maternity Hospital, they discovered hundreds of empty cradles. They found secret burial sites, and they found criminal ledgers indicating that between 1944 and 1948, Miyuki Ishikawa, her husband, and a doctor who falsified the death certificates were responsible for the deaths of 130 children. Can you process that? The story of a midwife seen as a saint who was quietly murdering children in the hundreds through starvation and exposure, right in the middle of a massive city where everyone was already starving. A woman who looked a desperate mother in the eye and promised to save her child while holding her child underwater. Is this the most disturbing Japanese urban legend ever conceived, born from the collective trauma of post-war devastation? Or was the Kotobuki Maternity Hospital a real place with real Silent Water in the nurseries? This was story number three, the Kotobuki case. All right, legends, this is where you hear which of the three stories is the real one, or at least based on the real one. I want you to leave a comment with your guess right now, okay? Which dark tide has actually swept over and into reality? Was it Jiro's boy Takeshi mutilated by the amphibious river imp? Was it Captain Sato saved by the dynamic destruction of his own bailing dippers? Or was it Miyuki Ishikawa and the nursery in Shinjuku? Folklore, you see, requires a kappa to operate with complex, bizarre, anatomical obsessiveness. A ghost ship requires supernatural communication. True crime, well, true crime usually just requires an indifferent society, a lack of oversight in a very convenient way to hide a body. The clock is running and the tide is about to rise. Do not skip ahead, or you'll be doomed to sail with the white-shrouded crew of the Sea of Japan for eternity. I'm just kidding. Just don't hop on any boats soon, okay? The truth, my friend, is that story number three, the Kotobuki Maternity Hospital and Miyuki Ishikawa, is 100% historically true. It is not an urban myth. Miyuki Ishikawa was a very real woman, is considered one of the most significant, disturbing, and systemically revealing child murder cases in modern history. Let me break down the hard history for you, because the reality is far more terrifying than any fable about a river spirit. So Ishikawa was a very real midwife. The criminal history confirms that between 1944 and 1948, Ishikawa and two accomplices, her husband and a falsifying doctor, orchestrated the systematic neglect, starvation, and exposure of 130 children under her care. She ran her clinic with the pragmatic coldness of an accountant, using the post-war devastation of Tokyo as a cloak. But perhaps the darkest part of this case isn't the death toll. It is the legal aftermath. At her 1948 trial, Ishikawa argued that she was not a killer, but a mercy killer, a saint who was simply preventing a life of guaranteed starvation in the ruins of Tokyo for unwanted children. She claimed she had requested aid from local officials and had been denied, leaving her with no other alternative. And in one of the most controversial rulings in post-war Japan's legal history, the Tokyo District Court conceded her point. They conceded that the unique apocalyptic post-war environment presented extreme difficulties for hospital management and child rearing. For the calculated murder of 130 children, Ishikawa was originally sentenced to only 8 years in prison. Goodness. She appealed the sentence, claiming she was a victim of her environment. The Tokyo High Court actually reduced her sentence. Ishikawa, the woman who orchestrated the death of 130 infants, served only 4 years in prison before being released under a new identity to live out the rest of her life in complete obscurity. Her husband and the falsifying doctor served only 4 months each 4 years for 130 lives in post-war Japan. This interactive ledger from tonight reminds us that folklore, monsters, and mythology are beautiful, terrifying, elaborate structures designed to make sense of the unknown. We need to believe that a cup mutilates children for supernatural reasons, because the alternative is that the system failed to build a proper bridge or failed a family. It's far too lazy and too devastating to accept. Folklore is perhaps a lie, maybe. Reality, though, is indifferent. It is a cold water bath under a nursery tap. Just awful. Before we lock up the dark archives for the night, I want to step into the warm corner of our tavern, our incredible Patreon community. This show stays alive, ad-free, and brewing late because of the direct support from listeners like you. Your generosity keeps the kettles boiling. Thank you so much for listening. And let's jump on into my thank yous. First is my jaw-dropping, my spectacular, my epic friend and supporter at the Ode Night Tea Titan tier is Matto Star. Matto, mate, thank you so much for being an absolute pillar in this community. Your ongoing encouragement and legendary support, your feedback, your comments, keeps the wheels turning behind the scenes every single week. Raise your cup high, my friend, to your wonderful, wonderful self. Thank you so much, legend. Have a brilliant, brilliant week. And did you get the guess right? Or was it too obvious? Do I have to mask it a little bit more? Is that the case, Matto? Let me know. Keen to hear your thoughts. And also, if you like the game structure of this episode. And to my White Teak Warlords, three in number. Next up, these legends are riding into the misty front lines to defend the Dark Chronicles and fuel the long nights of script writing. We honor our fierce and honorable White Teak Warlords. Firstly, Lesnosaurus Rex. Thank you for bringing your fierce, indestructible energy to the front lines every single week. You keep the studio doors guarded. Maya, the Queen of Cats. Thank you for your sharp feline watchfulness over our community. Your steady presence keeps the hearth cozy. And finally, but not least, of course, is Sangeetha the Seer. Thank you for your far-seeing wisdom and support, guiding our lantern light through these dark histories. To our warlord, tonight's true story from Shinjuku raised profound questions about morality and survival. When a society collapses, and this is a question to yourself, of course, listeners, and White Tea Warlords, and of course yourself, my Ode Night Tea Titan Matto. When a society collapses and we determine that a mother turning over her child to a saintly midwife to ensure its survival is an option, where do we draw the line between accidental negligence and pragmatic, calculated profit? 4 months. Remember that. 4 months. And now to my old grain forces. The muscle, the backbone, and the reliable brew that keeps this operation sharp and on the ground. Thank you for stepping into the alleyways with me and us. I am lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Raffaelli, Just Heather, Juicebox Andy, Divided by Zero, Paige Kramer, Jane Gumnick, Michael Krupp, and Steve the Creeper. Thank you, legends, for supporting me in the way you do. I have 3 tiers, each with different offerings. Thank you so much for your support. Feel free to email any story suggestions, any Japanese myth and lore you would like me to cover or incorporate and weave into a narrative of its own, perhaps one of the 3 stories that could be guessed next week. If you want to support what I do, Patreon is an option. You can search me, SFGT, Stories, Fables, Ghostly Tales, or you can leave an iTunes review or a Spotify review. That goes so far. If you have 10 seconds to leave that review, that would be amazing. Thank you again, everyone, for listening and supporting me. Now, the rivers of the Edo period may hide imps and the Sea of Japan may carry phantom fleets, but the coldest, deepest water will always be the silent tides of social trust when broken by a midwife holding a child and drown an entire nation in despair. Keep the tea hot, keep the porch lights burning against the dark rising sky, and as always, pleasant dreams if you can still sleep at all. I am your tale teller. Good night.